Ellicott subsidized his income from the motor industry by distributing OxyContin, crystal meth, and cocaine, and had recently expanded into heroin. All this Ouellette elected to share with the police because Caldicott, with whom she'd been living for the past 8 months, had suggested that she might like to sleep with Dale and maybe Gary, too, in order to calm them down and keep them distracted while Caldicott went out and took care of some urgent business. When Ouellette responded that she had no intention of fucking two transients just to keep them occupied, or for any other reason, good old Heb Caldicott, who seemed pretty overwrought himself to Ouellette, punched her so hard that she briefly lost consciousness. When she came to, Caldicott informed her that she'd fuck whomever he told her to fuck, and she ought to start making herself pretty for his friends, because they were going to spend time with her whether she liked it or not. Then he locked Ouellette in the bedroom, at which point she decided their relationship had come to its natural conclusion, and the best thing would be to climb out a window and seek accommodations elsewhere. She spent the night with a girlfriend, and only when she heard about the shooting of a state trooper on one of the news shows did she begin to suspect a connection between this incident and Caldicott's new arrivals. But it still took her a further 12 hours to contact police, her reluctance to do so not unrelated to Caldicott's narcotics business, of which she might not have been entirely unaware, her personal tastes extending to a little coke, she said, but only on weekends. Even with her suspicions, Ouellette made efforts to reach Caldicott before approaching the police. She did this, she first told detectives, because she wanted to be sure about everything before she got him in any trouble. Although she later admitted that she had been prepared to forgive Caldicott for their earlier misunderstanding involving assault and the threat of rape, because he had never hit her before, and was pretty generous with the coke. Unfortunately, when she returned to their shared abode, Caldicott was gone, along with his two buddies, the stash of coke, and $383 that Ouellette kept in an empty Humpty Dumpty potato chip bag taped under her bedside table. It was this final betrayal that caused Ouellette definitively to abandon all hopes of reconciliation with Heb Caldicott, and instead hang him out to dry for whatever he might or might not have done, along with his shitweasel buddies, their families, their children born and yet unborn, and their dogs. It hadn't taken long for the police to connect Heb Caldicott to one Dale Putnam and his buddy Gary Newhouse. Soon, law enforcement agencies across New England, along with their Canadian colleagues over the border, would be scouring the territories for them, and their pictures would be peering out from newspapers and TV screens throughout the Northeast. Which left only a succession of disgruntled Piscataquis County Sheriff's deputies to guard the burial site and complain about being left out of the action. Chapter 44. Guarding an empty hole in the ground was not, Deputy Rene Kellett had to admit, the most onerous of tasks, but it was among the dullest. Mostly she listened to music on her cell phone and studied her coursework. Kellett had completed an associate's degree in criminal justice and was now progressing toward a bachelor's in public safety administration. She enjoyed working for the sheriff's department, but her ambition was to move to a federal agency, and she had no hope of achieving this without a degree. So on one hand, she was earning some much-needed overtime by sitting in her car and moving along the occasional hunter or looky-loo who strayed too close to the dig site, while also effectively being paid to study. On the other hand, the kind of manhunt currently taking place for Putnam, Newhouse, and their buddy Caldicott was rare in this state, and it brought with it a buzz of purpose and excitement that was noticeably absent at this particular patch of woodland. This was Kellett's second shift on grave patrol, and she was hoping it might be the last. There was only so much reading and listening in solitude that a person could undertake before her mind began to wander. And in Kellett's experience, it never wandered anywhere good under such conditions as these. Maybe an artist or a writer could find inspiration in them, but she was neither. So instead of picturing great paintings or planning prize-winning books, she fretted about how her mom was starting to misremember stuff, or forget things entirely. How, with her dad gone, she'd be left to take care of her mom unaided, because her older brother wasn't worth a nickel on the dollar when it came to helping anyone other than himself. How that might impact on her plans to progress to Homeland Security, or, yeah, dream on, the FBI. And why, although she was an attractive woman without any complexes or peculiarities beyond the norm, she was experiencing a Dust Bowl level of drought in her sex life. Still, she performed with diligence her duties at the gravesite. At least once every hour, if only to stretch her legs, she walked the trail to make sure the canopy remained secure, because a wind had come down from the north that was strong enough to rock her car on its suspension, and if it could do that, it could also pick up a sheet of canvas and blast it toward Florida. It wasn't raining, though, which was some small consolation. The place was gloomy enough as it was, with or without a grave. Kellett had been one of the first on the scene when the body was initially discovered. She'd never seen remains in that state before. Like all police, she'd looked on her share of the dead. But she had not previously encountered a body buried in the ground for so long, yet still in a state of some preservation. The sight should have reminded her of old horror movies, creeping her out. But instead, she felt only a crushing sadness that she had not yet been able to shake off entirely. Although spending long hours alone by a burial pit probably wasn't helping any. Neither was the possibility that an infant child might also be interred in the vicinity. Although Kellett was beginning to believe this wasn't very likely, and she got the sense that those in command were thinking the same way. The wardens had almost concluded their search of the area, with no result. If the baby had died along with or soon after the mother, it stood to reason that it would have been buried with her. Kellett could have told them that to begin with. The wind picked up, and a noise intruded on her musings. The flapping of a tarp. It sounded like the big one over the grave. She'd already been forced to deal with it once, but she'd never claimed to be an expert on knots, and it looked as though this deficiency was coming back to haunt her. At least it was still light the first time she'd tackled the rope, but dusk had descended since then, and now she'd be forced to deal with it by flashlight. She climbed from the car, and the first drop of rain hit her on the crown of the head with the force of a thrown coin.
Oh, for crying out loud.
It wasn't even supposed to rain. Stupid meteorologists. And how many of them were actual meteorologists anyway? Most of them were just weathermen, for Pete's sake. If they had any qualification at all, it lay in being well turned out before breakfast. Kellett grabbed her hat and secured it under her chin, shrugged on her raincoat, and headed into the woods. The trees offered some shelter, but the ferocity of the downpour meant that branches could only do so much. Within a minute, the trail, treacherous even when dry, had turned positively lethal. Kellett tried to watch her step, but vigilance could only take a woman so far. She slipped as the tarp came in sight and went down hard on her right knee. The fall didn't hurt, but it left her trouser leg filthy and soaked. She tested it for any tears and found none, which was a relief. It was too early in the year to begin eating into her uniform allowance. Kellett looked to her right. Even without the aid of her flashlight, she could see the tarp waving in the wind. She didn't rush to get to it, fearful of slipping again. After all, it wasn't as though any evidence remained to be retrieved from the hole. The decision to keep it covered arose as much from a residual respect for the body it had once contained as it did from a desire to do everything by the book. She reached the site. The knot she had tied earlier had come undone. She grabbed the guy rope, but the wind yanked it from her hand, and the end lashed her cheek. Kellett rarely swore. She regarded it as a sign of poor breeding. But she came pretty close to uttering the first syllable of the F-bomb when the rope caught her.
"Gimme a break, huh?"
She wasn't sure whom she was addressing. God, maybe, assuming he wasn't too busy trying to separate folk intent on beheading one another in his name. Then again, God seemed to have enough free time on his hands to help football players score touchdowns and hillbillies win the lottery. So why not allocate a few of those spare seconds to not making her life any harder than it was? God, Kellett sometimes thought, needed to get his priorities straight. She was just getting a grip on the rope when she froze. She had neither seen nor heard anything untoward, yet was conscious of the rapid beating of her heart, the tensing of the muscles in her legs, and the piloerection reflex as the tiny muscles at the base of each hair follicle contracted, covering her with goosebumps. Fear, unlike any she had ever experienced before. Kellett released the rope and reached for her gun, crossing her right hand over her left, so beam and weapon moved in unison. As she did so, she retreated to the cover of the spruce nearest the hole, conscious that the flashlight made her an easier target if she remained in the open.
"Sheriff's deputy," she shouted. "This area's restricted. You're trespassing on a crime scene."
Kellett listened, but received no response, only the sound of rain falling on leaf, branch, and dirt. She drew a deep breath and tried to determine the source of the threat. She was facing back down the trail toward her vehicle and could see no activity in that direction. She was relying entirely on atavistic instinct by now, but her best guess was that whatever had spooked her was to the south or west of her position, because it had been behind her when she was dealing with the guy line. She risked a look around the trunk of the tree and saw a figure clearly silhouetted between two trees on a rise to the south of the site. Despite the bulk of its outdoor clothing and the distance involved, Kellett was certain she was looking at a woman. Then, seconds later, the figure turned and was gone. Kellett released a breath. Just a rubbernecker. No one worth chasing. She'd make a note of it in her log and warn Mel White when he arrived to relieve her, just so he'd know to keep an eye out. She was putting her gun back in its holster when she heard a wet sliding sound from behind, followed by a splash as something landed in the mud and water at the base of the grave. Only then did she notice her goosebumps had not disappeared, and her heartbeat had not slowed. She drew the gun again and quietly shifted position, stepping softly around the tree until the gravesite was revealed to her. The canvas continued to flap and the rain fell, so her view of what lay beneath was partial and restricted. But she could detect movement in the dirt, as though some large animal were digging in an effort to conceal itself from the approach of a predator. Flap. And she could feel its fear, because it was so much like her own, and discern its shape, because this also resembled hers. It lay curled in the depression left by the body of the dead woman, and although the dimensions had been altered by the removal of the remains and the subsequent search for the child, still it seemed to fit the cavity with ease. Flap. And now it appeared to become aware of a threat more imminent than the one from which it had fled. And as it turned its face toward Kellett, she discerned the rot of it, and the hollow concavities of its eyes, and its belly, both distended yet withered. And all it was, and all it might once have been. Yet it was not a thing composed entirely of bone and old skin. Kellett saw wood and ivy, twigs and small animal bones, as though it had been forced to scavenge to complete itself. It opened its mouth as a beast might in order to shriek an alarm or growl a warning. Flap. And then it was moving again, digging deeper into the bank, exposing a hole either recently made or previously unknown. And into this it dragged itself, its body contorting with serpentine paroxysms, until all that remained visible was the sole of a foot, a spur of bone exposed at the heel, before this too was gone. And the mud and dirt slid down to fill the gap behind. so it was as if it had never been. Its presence in this world no more than the conjuring of an unquiet mind, even as the consciousness that had imagined it, Kellett's own, grew dim, and she fell back against the tree and let it support her as she dropped to the ground, where she sat, conscious yet unseeing, until the arrival of Mel White's vehicle summoned her from her stupor, and she descended to meet him, but said nothing, beyond a distant figure glimpsed of what she had witnessed. Chapter 45. The birth rate in Maine had been falling consistently over the previous decade, which still left Parker with almost 13,000 registered live births for the year in which the woman in the woods had died. In the quiet of his home office, he opened a map of Piscataquis in his Maine Atlas and Gazetteer, marked the location of the gravesite, then placed the point of a compass on the dot, and drew a circle with a generous radius of approximately 15 miles. The circle did not break the borders of the county. If he was correct in his assumption of local knowledge, and it seemed reasonable to begin with that and expand the search only if necessary, then he was now looking at just 160 registered births during the year in question. This could be narrowed still further, Parker believed, thanks to his visit to the grave. The body had been buried 3 feet below ground, which was a considerable depth, and suggested the work of an individual operating with little or no fear of being disturbed. But digging a hole of that size and draft wouldn't be possible during the deepest winter months, as the ground would just be too hard. So he could probably exclude children registered in December and January. He was tempted to exclude February, too, but decided to err on the side of caution. Ground cold enough to preserve a body then, yet not so cold as to be unworkable. But in addition to births, more than 200 legal adoptions of children were processed through the Public Child Welfare Agency in Maine for the same period, with many more using licensed private agencies. With the birth rate as a gauge, this meant registered legal adoptions in Piscataquis County probably didn't amount to more than a handful, and he could rule out any children whose age at adoption was outside his parameters. All of which presupposed that the person responsible for burying the mother had chosen to hide his or her tracks either by registering the birth under another woman's name, or had come up with a story convincing enough to result in a formal adoption. Neither, Parker knew, would have been particularly difficult. But he decided to examine the simpler of the two options first, which was to register the birth. Under the state's revised statutes, one of four individuals was required to prepare and file a certificate for a birth occurring outside a hospital or institution, a physician or other person in attendance at the birth, the father, the mother, or the person in charge of the premises where the live birth took place, which could be anyone from a hotel proprietor to the guy who ran the local gas station. If the mother was not married at either conception or birth, the details of the putative father could not be entered on the certificate without both his written consent and that of the mother. In other words, there was little to stop a woman turning up with a child in her arms and filing a birth certificate with the clerk of the municipality, unless, of course, the woman was known to the clerk personally, in which case questions might be asked about the sudden appearance of an unexpected child. But Piscataquis, at more than 4,000 square miles, was the second largest county in the state, and also the most sparsely populated, with about 17,000 people residing within its borders, a lot of them existing below the poverty line. Those kinds of statistics were conducive to isolation, and places like Piscataquis and farther north, Aroostook, tended to attract the kind of folks who preferred to be left to their own devices, by and large. This did not make Parker's task any easier. The Division of Public Health Systems in Augusta retained most of the information he required. Parker considered taking a trip north the following day to see what he could discover. He also went through his Rolodex and found the name of a contact at the Maine Town and City Clerks Association, which had more than 700 members across the state, one of whom might have unwittingly registered the birth of the dead woman's child. But he'd hold off on asking for a favor until he'd scoured the vital records available to him in Augusta. By then, his back and sides ached from sitting for too long, a legacy of his gunshot wounds, and his eyes were watering. He knew that his eyesight was getting worse, but he didn't want to go back to his optometrist for a new prescription. He had somehow managed to convince himself that he required spectacles only for reading and looking at screens, and could get away with not wearing them all the time. He remembered discussing the problem with Angel, who had been noticeably unsympathetic.
"Vanity,"
was Angel's conclusion. "It's not vanity. It's a matter of practicality."
"You tell yourself that. The rest of us'll go for answer A. You're too vain to admit you need 'em. I bet you color your hair, too."
"If I was coloring my hair, I'd opt for something other than gray."
"Maybe you're being sneaky and you're just going far enough to hide the worst of it."
"I don't know why I talk to you about anything. It's like arguing with a rubber ball."
"Buy the glasses,"
says the man who had to be threatened before he'd see a doctor about the pains in his stomach.
"Yeah, and look where that got me."
At which point Angel had gestured to the hospital room, the bed, and the cannula in his arm. It was the night before the procedure, and the last time Parker would be permitted the pleasure of the old Angel's company. When next Parker saw him, Angel's skin would be gray, and he would be missing a length of intestine. "I think you just hold your own argument," said Parker.
"No," Angel replied. "I was just too dumb to listen until it was too late."
Angel's voice broke. Parker reached out and held Angel's right hand. "Late," said Parker, "but not too late."
"I'm scared."
"I know."
"Not just for myself."
"I know that, too."
"If I die..."
"You're not gonna die."
"What do you know? You can't even see straight. If I die..."
"Yes?"
"I think Louis's always been looking for someone to put him out of his pain, just as you once did."
"But you stopped him. He's different now."
"Nah, he's not. It's still sleeping inside him. That desire for an ending. Don't ever let him use me as an excuse."
"I'll see what I can do."
"He listens to you."
"I don't think he does. You're mistaking silence for listening."
"Maybe. And you can let go of my hand now."
"Sorry."
"Don't be."
They were quiet for a time. "If you die," said Parker.
"Yeah?"
"I'm not gonna date Louis just to make him feel better. That hand-holding, it was only me being comforting."
"Don't make me laugh. It hurts."
"I'm just saying."
"Get out of here."
Parker stood. He paused at the door. "Angel?"
"Uh-huh."
"No dying, you hear?"
"Yes,"
said Angel.
"I hear."
Chapter 46. Louis sat by Angel's bedside. Some ruddiness had returned to Angel's cheeks, or perhaps this was simply wishful thinking on the part of his partner. Angel was still pumped full of the kind of medication that left the world a blur and made arduous all but the simplest and shortest of endeavors. Now Angel was sleeping while the night laid claim to the world beyond his window. 2 hours went by, during which Louis read. Reading had not previously consumed much of his time, but here in this hospital room he had begun to find in books both an escape from his cares and a source of solace when their avoidance proved impossible. Uncertain of where to start, he had sourced a number of lists of the 100 greatest novels ever written, which he combined to create his own guide. So far in the course of Angel's illness, Louis had read The Call of the Wild, Lord of the Flies, and Invisible Man, both the Ellison and Wells titles, due to a mix-up at the bookstore. But Louis didn't mind, as both were interesting in their different ways. He was currently on The Wind in the Willows, the inclusion of which had initially appeared to represent some form of cataloging error. But the book had grown pleasantly strange as his explorations of it progressed.
"Why are you still here?"
asked a voice from the bed.
"I'm trying to finish a chapter."
Angel sounded hoarse. Louis put down the novel and fetched the no-spill water cup with its flexible straw. He held it until Angel waved a hand to signal he was done. Angel's eyes seemed clearer than they had been since before the operation, like those of a man who was woken after a long, undisturbed rest.
"What are you reading now?"
Angel asked.
"The Wind in the Willows." "Isn't that for kids?"
"Maybe. Who cares?"
"And after that?"
Louis reached for his coat and removed a folded sheet of paper. He examined the contents of the list.
"I might try something older. You ever read Dickens?"
"Yeah, I read Dickens."
"Which one?"
"All of them."
"Seriously? I never knew that about you."
"I read a lot when I was younger, and when I was in jail. Big books. I even read Ulysses."
"Nobody's read Ulysses, or nobody we know."
"I have."
"Did you understand it?"
"I don't think so. Finished it, though, which counts for something."
"You still read now. You always have a book by the bed."
"I don't read the way I used to. Not like that."
"You ought to start again."
Louis waved his paper.
"I got a list you can use."
"The Wind in the Willows, huh?"
"That's right."
"So read me something from it."
"You mean out loud?"
"You think I'm psychic? I'm gonna guess the words?"
Louis glanced at the half-open door. He had never read aloud to anyone in his life, nor had he been read aloud to. He could recall his mother singing to him as a child, but never reading stories, not unless they were from the Bible. He thought of Angel's bodyguards. He didn't want them to return and find him voicing rats and toads.
"You too embarrassed to read to me?"
asked Angel.
"If I die, you'll be..."
"Okay," said Louis. "Not the dying again. You want me to go back to the beginning?"
"Nah, just from where you're at."
With one final check of the door, Louis began.
"The line of the horizon was clear and hard against the sky," he read, "and in one particular quarter it showed black against a silvery climbing phosphorescence that grew and grew. At last, over the rim of the waiting earth, the moon lifted with slow majesty till it swung clear of the horizon and rode off, free of moorings. And once more they began to see surfaces, meadows widespread, and quiet gardens, and a river itself from bank to bank, all softly disclosed, all washed clean of mystery and terror, all radiant again as by day, but with a difference that was tremendous. Their old haunts greeted them again in other raiment, as if they had slipped away and put on this pure new apparel and come quietly back, smiling as they shyly waited to see if they would be recognized again under it. All was still. Angel was once again asleep. Louis stopped reading.
"That,"
said Tony Fulci from his seat on the floor,
"was fucking beautiful."
Beside him, his brother Paulie, fellow bodyguard and now, it appeared, literary critic, nodded in agreement.
"Yeah, fucking beautiful."
Chapter 47. Quayle and Moores headed northwest, taking rooms at the Mill Inn and Dover Foxcroft. The town lay near the edge of Piscataquis County, about 20 miles southeast of where the remains of Jane Doe had been discovered. While Moores was resting, Quayle was thinking of Mela Lombardi. He regretted her death for both practical and personal reasons. Practical, because her disappearance would eventually attract attention, and it would be best if he and Moores were long gone from this place when it did. And personal, because Lombardi had at least been a woman of principle and courage, and Quail retained the capacity to admire such qualities. And for all the risks he and Moores had taken in interrogating Lombardi before killing her and disposing of the body, they had emerged only with confirmation that Karis Lamb had made it as far as Maine, and Lombardi's opinion that the remains found in Piscataquis were hers. But this was lent further credence by the press conference held earlier that day, an adjunct to the ongoing hunt for the killers of the state trooper Jasper Allen. Before taking questions from the media, a female lieutenant had gone into greater detail than before about the age and approximate build of the woman, both of which matched descriptions of Karis. She had also informed the media that a Star of David carved on a nearby tree might have some connection to the body. Quail knew from the late Vernet that Karis habitually wore a small Star of David on a chain around her neck. Vernet had found her attachment to this symbol of her mother's faith amusing. Quail suspected it added to the pleasure Vernet took in Lamb's defilement. Unbeknownst to Quail, he was operating on a similar set of assumptions to Charlie Parker, that Karis's child was still alive and very possibly living in some proximity to the grave. Quail had sent Moores to scout the site. Although she only narrowly avoided apprehension by the police officer assigned to guard it. And her view was that it had been chosen specifically for its remoteness, which suggested local knowledge. But Quail possessed an advantage over any other parties, including the police, who might now be looking for Karis Lamb's missing child. Quail knew about the book. That evening, Parker called the Upper West Side apartment shared by Louis and Angel. When Louis answered, Parker inquired after Angel's health before progressing to the other reason for the call. I had a face-to-face conversation with Bobby Ocean a few days ago.
Uh-huh, said Louis,
and how is that?
Like soaking my brain in bile. He stopped just short of presenting me with a bill for his son's truck.
Does the boy usually let his father do his dirty work?
I don't think Billy knew about the visit.
Why not?
Bobby Ocean shares some of his son's moral failings, but the stupidity gene may have skipped a generation. If Billy were to find out who was responsible for blowing up his pride and joy, he might take it into his head to seek some retribution. Bobby's guess is that this wouldn't end well for anyone, but particularly not for his son, and possibly not for him either.
So he came to you to let off a little steam? Sorry for the inconvenience.
I've had worse.
This Billy doesn't sound like an honor roll kid.
You remember our friend Philip from Providence?
Philip was the unacknowledged offspring of a liaison between a deceased New England criminal named Casper Webb and the woman who would eventually inherit and dismantle Webb's empire, a figure known only as Mother. Philip had objected strenuously to Mother's disposal of the family franchise, believing himself a worthy heir to his father's fortune, and was now rumored to be taking an extended vacation. If so, it was the kind conducted horizontally and under a weight of dirt.
Hard to forget him, said Louis, but I am trying.
Well, I think Billy has similar paternal issues, minus the outright criminality, but with prejudice to compensate.
Maybe I shouldn't have blown up the truck.
We live and learn. They talked some more, and Parker told Louis about the body of the woman and the search for her child.
If the kid is alive, said Louis, then someone is probably starting a panic right about now. You think he could be in danger?
No.
You sure about that?
The mother died from severe hemorrhaging very soon after giving birth. It's likely that someone buried her with enough care and respect to carve the symbol of her religion on a nearby tree. That doesn't strike me as the act of a person who'd harm a child.
Just the act of a person who wanted a child badly enough to bury its mother in a shallow grave.
When you put it that way. They returned to the subject of the truck. Parker wasn't sure how much Bobby Ocean actually knew about Louis beyond rumor and reputation, but if he expended enough time and effort, he might be able to find out more.
It would be better for all concerned if Louis were absent from Portland for a while. Although given Louis's current mood, Parker guessed that the city would soon be graced once again by his presence.
The hospital will get Angel walking in a day or two, encourage him to eat and drink, then send him home, said Louis. Well, that's the plan.
Parker knew that Louis would be engaging nurses to assist Angel during the early stages of his recovery. The internist felt it wasn't strictly necessary, but Louis would have been the first to admit that he wasn't one of nature's caregivers. Parker said that he'd come visit once Angel was settled back in the apartment. They agreed to speak again in a few days. And death circled. Chapter 48. They called themselves the Backers, individuals who had attained positions of considerable wealth, power, and influence, in part through their own efforts and acumen, but mostly by aligning themselves with forces older and more arcane than any religion. In doing so, they had damned themselves, and were therefore content to see all others damned in turn. Now five of them, three men and two women, were seated at a table in the Oak Room at the Fairmont Copley Plaza in Boston, the grand dame of the city's hotel bars. In recent years, it had been rebranded as the Oak Long Bar and Kitchen. But this quintet, like many of the city's blue bloods, chose to ignore the change. To them, it was the Oak Room, and always would be. They attracted no particular attention, apart from the solicitous but not overbearing service of their waiter. On this particular evening, the bar was entertaining half a dozen not dissimilar parties of senior patrons, all casually attired, or casually for them, which meant jackets and ties for the gentlemen and dresses for the women. Their coterie eschewed cocktails for gins and white wine, and declined offers of food since they had a reservation at L'Espalier for 8 p.m. Like their meeting, the reservation had been arranged at short notice, but with no great difficulty.
"Well,"
said one of the women, once the drinks were served and they could speak without being overheard. She looked over at the principal backer, he who had called them together.
"One imagines this is not principally a social gathering."
The principal backer raised his glass in a silent toast and took a sip before replying. "Quail is in New England." The woman who had spoken grimaced, as though the wine were not quite to her taste.
"Where?"
"Maine."
"Why?"
"Have you been following the story of the woman's body found in the northern woods?"
"I think I read something about it. Wasn't she pregnant?"
"Not quite. She gave birth shortly before she died. Quail thinks he knows who she is. Apparently he's been looking for her for some time."
"So now he can return home," said a thin, dark man with the aspect of a sad, emaciated crow. "His search, it would appear, is at an end."
The others nodded their agreement. One of the men even laughed. Bluster, thought the principal backer. None was willing to look the others in the face. All feared seeing their own disquietude reflected. "Unfortunately," he said, "his efforts have not yet concluded. He's now seeking the missing child."
"You've spoken with him?" asked the crow man.
"Not directly, but he has made contact. He has requested our assistance. Request, in this case, being something of a euphemism." Quail operated largely in seclusion and solitude, a succession of female partners accepted. In times past, he had enjoyed a more public profile, but no longer. Nevertheless, he was a figure of influence, and not one to be denied.
"What use would a man like Quail have for a child?"
asked the other woman present. The principal backer thought he detected what might almost have been concern in her tone. She sat on the boards of a number of charities, including at least two that specialized in seeking cures for pediatric illnesses. Perhaps he considered her hypocrisy had become so ingrained that she was no longer even capable of perceiving it as such.
"I don't think he's especially interested in the child itself," said the principal backer, "although if he did want it, would you really care to know his reasons?"
The woman did not reply. Her silence was sufficient response.
"Then why persist?" asked the man who had laughed, his expression restored to its default smirk.
The principal backer distrusted those who laughed too easily, perceiving in it a deeper inability to find anything funny at all.
"The mother possessed something Quail wants. He believes that this object now resides with whomever has the child."
No one needed to ask why this asset was of interest to Quail. The lawyer had only one purpose to his existence, the reconstruction of the fractured atlas, which would reorder the world in its image.
"What kind of assistance does he require from us?"
asked the second woman.
"Contacts. Police, municipal government, whatever else may strike him."
"And we're obliging?"
"Naturally."
"While ensuring that we're kept apprised of any developments?"
"Where possible."
The principal backer waited for their approval to subside. They were coming to the meat of it now.
"Quail believes he's close," he said, "closer than he has ever been."
"But how close?" said the Crow Man. "We've heard all this before. My father listened to the same claims coming from Quail's mouth."
Another bark of laughter.
"Your grandfather, too, and mine."
The principal backer waited for them to stop. They were of old blood, and old blood grew torpid.
"The last of the missing pages," he said, "if Quail is to be believed."
The other four absorbed this information.
"And then?"
asked the woman of charitable disposition.
"If Quail is right, the world will become a reflection of the Atlas. The not gods will return, and the old god will pass into non-being. All will be fed to the flames."
No laughter now. These backers, like those long gone before them, had predicated their existence on the belief that they could pass on the cost of their bargain to future generations. They would be dead before the consequences of their actions were made manifest. Or perhaps this pact with an evil that had come into being with the birth of the universe, a covenant agreed centuries earlier, might ultimately be revealed as mere myth, so much sophistry to explain away good fortune. Their success would not come at a price. The not-gods did not exist. There was no buried god lost deep beneath the dirt and rock of this world, waiting to be discovered. Just as there was no old god seeking adoration and remembrance. There was only this life, and then nothingness. But no, they knew the truth. They had only hoped to be gone before it was revealed.
"So," said the Crow Man, "we must collude with Quail in our own destruction and the extinction of those we love?"
The Crow Man had family, children, a grandchild. So did the others. Only the principal backer was without heirs.
"We have always been in a state of collusion," said the principal backer. "The abstract now threatens to become concrete." "But what did you expect?"
"More time."
"It appears you may be denied it. Why do you think I booked L'Espalier for our meal?"
"I believe," said the Crow Man, "that I may have lost my appetite."
The principal backer gripped him by the shoulder.
"Then find it again," he said. "This could be our last supper."
Chapter 49. If the principal backer and his associates were ambivalent about the presence of the visitor, Quail was no less eager to maintain his distance from these colonials. He regarded them as lacking purity. They acted largely out of self-interest, seeking to enrich themselves by subscribing to a doctrine in which they all believed only half-heartedly, if they truly believed in it at all. Only the leader of their little group was worthy of any respect. There were those who suspected the principal backer to be black as pitch to the depths of his being. Although Quail had no idea what might have bred in him such hatred for his fellow men, that the principal backer should be content to see them reduced to ash, and himself along with them. Quail wondered if the buried god whispered to the principal backer in the night, calling to him in a tongue ancient and unwritten, its words unintelligible, but their meaning clear. If so, it might have gone some way toward explaining the principal backer's animus toward Quail, who served the rest of the obverse trinity. But Quail had other doubts about the principal backer. Quail possessed no evidence at which to point, no indications of irresolution or, whisper it, treachery on the part of the principal backer. Only his knowledge of men and the depths of their self-interest. The principal backer was prosperous and in good health. He was held in regard. He had authority. He had no reason to bring all of it to an end. Quail, by contrast, was a soul in anguish, and wished only for that suffering to cease. If a way had existed to accomplish this other than through the restoration of the Atlas, Quail might have embraced it without hesitation. Or so he told himself. Quail was a man convinced that he had lived for centuries, cursed. In an irony only a lawyer could properly appreciate, by a contract he should not have signed. He could recall moments of great import going back to the Reformation, intimate details of incidents and individuals about which he could not possibly have such knowledge. He was haunted by memories that seemed to belong both to him and to others, a succession of men who bore his name and likeness, but could not be him. Once again, as he did whenever he experienced doubt, he feared that these echoes were simply manifestations of mania, while the insight that permitted him to acknowledge his own lunacy represented a clarity that ebbed and flowed according to the patterns of his psychosis. Lies within lies. Like the backers, he would find no consolation in them. The Atlas was real. The old god was real. The buried god was real. The not gods to come were real. And Quail, in all his singularity, was real. Chapter 50. Parker spent part of the following morning in Augusta going through the relevant birth records for Piscataquis County. He managed to assemble a list of registrations from the period in question, but remained reluctant to go knocking on doors to ask about illegal burials and child abductions. Someone would shoot him. Terry Harkness, his contact at the Maine Town and City Clerks Association, agreed to inquire about birth certificate filings that might have raised an eyebrow, but she didn't hold out much hope. Clerks took their role seriously, she said, and nobody wanted a false filing to come back and bite. But she did admit that when it came to home births, they couldn't do much more than take the word of the parent or parents, and she had personal knowledge of two very religious families in which grandparents were raising a grandchild as their own in order to protect a daughter from opprobrium.
"And shouldn't the police be asking these questions anyway?"
said Harkness. The clerk at the Vital Records office in Augusta told me they'd already received a request from the state police for assistance, now that the search of the site is winding down, said Parker. But resources are likely to be stretched until they find Jasper Allen's killers. My guess is that the police will be in touch with more of your members soon enough. But maybe I can save them some trouble.
If you do figure out who has the child, you have to know they won't be too pleased to see you.
If I let the likely pleasure of my company guide my movements, Parker told her, I'd never leave the house. Putnam, Newhouse, and Caldecott had proved smarter than anyone might previously have credited, and had so far managed to evade the police. The general view was that Caldecott was the bright one, although it was all relative, given that he was a mid-level Maine drug dealer now being hunted as a possible accessory to the killing of a state trooper. If Caldecott was clever, Parker thought, he'd have ditched Putnam and Newhouse as quickly as possible and headed north or west. Parker's guess was north, maybe into the county, as everyone in Maine called Aroostook, the largest territory in the state, almost 7,000 square miles, most of it uninhabited woodland. Caldecott knew the terrain. His people came from up Scopan way, close to the Allagash Wilderness. A man could lose himself in there and not be found until someone stumbled on his bones. But if Caldecott was really clever, and also ruthless, he'd have done more than ditch Putnam and Newhouse. He'd have killed them. Right now, there was only the word of his girlfriend that he'd supplied the car used in the shooting, and the presence of Putnam and Newhouse at Caldecott's place on the night in question didn't directly link him to Allen's death. While the distinction between being an accessory before or after the fact had largely been erased in law, the reality was that an accessory after the fact faced a lighter sentence. As things stood, Caldecott was only in trouble for knowingly assisting a suspected felon or felons in avoiding arrest or trial, unless the police investigation uncovered evidence linking him to the planning of the drug buy that had ultimately resulted in Allen's murder. There was also the testimony of Caldecott's junkie girlfriend to consider, although it appeared she had now lawyered up in order to counter any possibility of her own indictment as an accessory, and junkies made poor witnesses. Whatever happened, Caldecott was in trouble. But he might be in less trouble if Putnam and Newhouse were to vanish from the face of the earth. None of which was Parker's problem. He returned to the matter of the unidentified woman. What did he know of her? She was probably from out of state. So how did she come to be in Maine? What drew her to the northeast? She was pregnant, so it was possible that the father of the child was here. Yet somehow, she ended up going into labor not in the safety of a hospital but out in the wild, and any witnesses to the birth and her subsequent passing had not seen fit to alert the authorities. Could the father of the child have been responsible for her burial? If so, why hide the body and the fact of the birth, unless he panicked when the woman died, fearing that the law might find a way to blame him for it? What if he was married, and the pregnancy the result of an affair? The lover shows up in his home state, heavy with his child, and he finds somewhere to accommodate her without his wife suspecting. When the woman dies after giving birth, he gets rid of her along with the child and returns to his blameless life. But if that was so, why wasn't the child buried with the mother? Parker rode back. One certainty. This was a woman in trouble, because otherwise she would not have ended up in a hole in the woods. She was heavily pregnant, in an unfamiliar locale. To whom would she have turned? Planned Parenthood, perhaps, or one of the women's refuges. Yet no such organization in the state had come forward to claim knowledge of her. Parker experienced a tickling at his memory, a detail from the past that was assuming new relevance in light of the current case. Then it came to him, and he made one final call, this time to Bangor. The woman with whom he wished to speak was absent, and would not be back until nightfall. Parker left a message advising that he would travel up to talk to her in person the next day. He knew he could have spoken with her over the phone, but he had learned from long experience that people, even those with no grudge against him, were often more forthcoming when dealt with face to face. And anyway, he had other obligations that night. Chapter 51. Quail did not like bars, or not bars like this, loud, convivial, and filled with staff that might remember a face. Quail preferred older, darker watering holes, frequented by men and women who did not exchange glances or make conversation with those unknown to them, and only barely acknowledge those they did know. Places with names originating from a time when the masses could not read, and inns were identifiable by their signs. But perhaps in those London hostelries that had been in the same family for generations, a landlord might remark to his son or daughter as they cleaned glasses or pulled pints, that the customer seated in the corner,
"A legal gentleman, if memory serves,"
enjoyed a similar hereditary link to their beloved establishment. For this man's father used to drink here, and indeed his father before him.
"For they bear the same likeness, which speaks of a strong bloodline."
Even if the appellation of this august lineage of clientele would not quite come to the innkeeper.
"Something to do with birds, I'm sure of it."
And it would never cross his mind to ask, because he was certain that this gentleman
keeps himself to himself, but pleasant enough with it,
would not welcome such inquiries. And perhaps the reason he and his forebears had offered their patronage down the years was precisely this discretion on the part of a long line of landlords.
"For we know when to look and when to look away."
And so it should remain. Therefore, Quail felt unusually conspicuous in a booth at the Great Loss Bear in Portland, even with Moore's keeping vigil from the bar, the stools at either side of her curiously unoccupied, despite the presence of a large crowd, and with seating at a premium. Quail sat with a gin before him, although he had barely touched it. He had no desire to be here, and therefore drinking would give him no pleasure. This whole country was encrusting him, like dust falling in the aftermath of an eruption. He wanted to be done with it. A man made his way through the throng, his body undulating so that no matter how densely packed the masses, he passed between all without difficulty. He was small and slim, but had learned to make himself less noticeable still. He was dressed in an overcoat that looked older than he, its sleeves hanging below his knuckles, its hem frayed. His eyes were brown and hooded, and his hair very dark and full, its line so close to his eyebrows that he barely possessed a forehead at all. His nose was tiny and pointed. Combined with the coat and the swift precision of his movements, these features lent him the aspect of a clever rodent. Quail caught him squint at Moore's and hold the look she gave him, and Quail thought that the principal backer must have described her to the new arrival in forewarning. He held a soda in one hand, but he struck Quail as being no more likely to finish it than Quail was his gin. He took the facing seat in the booth without asking permission and placed his glass on a coaster. He did not offer a hand in greeting, and Quail surmised that this, too, the principal backer might have mentioned to him.
"Mr. Quail prefers not to shake hands. You should probably be grateful for it, otherwise you might never remove the chill from your fingers, assuming Quail leaves you with as many of them as before."
"You're the Englishman."
No names, no preamble. His voice was too high for a grown male, and curiously without accent. He could have been from anywhere. Anywhere at all.
"Yes," said Quail.
"You like this place?"
"No," said Quail. "Why did you bring me here?"
"Because you're looking for the child."
With the tiniest nod of that rat-like head, he indicated a man at the other side of the bar, engaged in conversation with an older, bearded figure.
"And so was he."
It was Dave Evans's birthday, and various friends had gathered to wish the owner of the Great Lost Bear well. With Angel and Louie indisposed, and the Fulci brothers acting as temporary bodyguards for the invalid, it was particularly incumbent on Parker to be present. Not that this was in any way a chore, because he owed Dave a lot. Dave had offered Parker a bar manager's job back when times were hard, both personally and financially, and the Bear still functioned as Parker's de facto meeting place and occasional office.
"You hear the Fulcis are looking to open a bar of their own?" he remarked to Dave. "I thought it was just a rumor, Like trickle-down economics. No, they sound serious. They have the money, and I hear they put a marker somewhere on Washington Avenue. That's too close to us, said Dave. Washington Avenue was right on the other side of town from the Bear. How far away do